Are they making fun of me? Okay, everyone, tonight we're going to be working in the beginning of Parshas Pekudei. Let me get Bella back on the phone for us.
I just think it's good.
It's a good place.
Hello, Bella?
Yes.
Okay, are you with us? Everyone here sends their warm regards. The only thing... You have the stone edition. Okay, we'll be coming across with the page number in a minute. Maybe you want to give us the page. Would you honor us with giving us the beginning of Parshas Pekudei? What page is it? Be warned, there are people racing you.
I got it here.
Okay, what page is it?
Got it here. Page Streetbusters.
530.
Is that what it is?
Right?
Page 530 in the stone.
Right?
Jessica, what would you like us to know about the Hertz?
385.
Page 385 in the Hertz. Okay. Now, Bella, since you're listening at home, I just have to warn you one thing. If you want to say something, don't raise your hand. All right. So you might have, you have to talk up. Okay. Okay. Now, Parshas Pekudei is a beautiful little parsha. It's in much of its material would be classified as a little dense and repetitive. However, it is also a parsha that is often obscured under the shadow of its larger, older sister, Vayakhel. Right? I assume it's older because I assume Moshe wrote it in order. So by the time he wrote Pekudei, he'd already written Vayakhel. Anyway, Pekudei is interesting, and tonight I would like to feature my late beloved teacher, Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zichrono Livracha. Used to in his famous Chumash lectures that he delivered in London, each of which is just a surpassing classic. I mean, he had a way of teaching the classical Mefarshim of Chumash that I have never heard anyone duplicate. That when if you can imagine Shakespeare channeling the Sephorno, you have some notion of what it was like to listen to Rabbi Bernstein, Zichrono Livracha. In any case, he would always introduce his shiurim, and he'd say, I found for you Kara Metzias. I found for you a treasure like a diamond. You wouldn't believe it. So found a couple of very interesting, or he would sometimes say, an interesting item. So we have some interesting items this evening. And they address the beginning of Parshas Pekudei. Now, in order to see the enterprise of the opening of Parshas Pekudei, I would suggest that you use the following analogy. Oh, what a... We have our precious new Zanes with us. So please come in. Okay, the beginning of Parshas Pekudei. Dan, would you make sure that they have chumashim and take care of everybody?
That's mine's.
Okay. We have them. We'll take care of you. This group is like the warmest group you'll ever fall into. We take care of everybody. Okay. Now, if you think, entertain the following image, if you'd like. Imagine that you have a clear piece of plastic. And on this piece of plastic, you have a series of black dots, which seem to be arranged in no particular order. They seem to be random, chaotic dots. And you're asking yourself, what do these dots mean? Well, if someone with just the right kind of eye will take that plastic and place it over a picture, and what you come to see is that those dots represent key elements in this picture. So I once was teaching this, and I was sitting with my dear friend Laurie Oppenheim, and she is always showing me the beautiful picture of the shul in her city. She grew up in Hanover, Germany, and the city and the shul was exceptionally beautiful. And so I've seen it, you know, a dozen times. And I was explaining this concept to her. I said, imagine if you took these random dots and you placed them over that beautiful shul. And you saw that the dots on the end represented the extent of the walls, and another one the place of the dome, and another one marked the spot where the beautiful doors were and the stair. And these dots clearly were created to define a pattern, sort of the way in which the constellations are imagined to show us shapes of various bodies and figures in the heavens. But it takes a genius to look at the dots and to imagine what picture is the right picture to place behind them. I would say that this particular approach characterizes both the approaches of the Sforno, one of our old friends, and of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, whom we discussed, I believe, last week as well, in a different context. And what you need to appreciate first is the apparent, the strange chaotic nature of the first verses, like the first three verses in Parshas Pikudei. Because it says, Eile Pikudei HaMishkan, these are, and Unkelus says, Minyonei, the numbers, the account, the countings of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And then the Torah does something very strange. It seems to repeat itself in a kind of an appositional formation. In other words, comma, which Mishkan are we talking about? Mishkan HaEdus, the tabernacle of... Now, Edus is a strange... The tabernacle of testimony. Now, of course, testimony can go broadly in one of two ways. What is the first association which we have with that word? Jessica, what occurs to you when we talk about Edus?
The Ten Commandments.
Excellent. So we speak about the Luchos HaEdus, right? The tablets of testimony is one of the ways in which we refer to the Ten Commandments. And that is indeed what we might call a major thoroughfare. That's what makes the Mishkan the Mishkan, is the tablets, the holy tablets that Moshe brought down, and according to tradition, even the broken pieces of the original tablets were also in the ark. And we know that mechanism where the divine voice came from the two cherubic figures over the ark, and we know, okay. However, there is also the other side of the fork in the road, because it is Mishkan HaEdus, which may mean that the Mishkan itself testifies to something. Oh. So, indeed, the Luchos HaEdus, they are tablets which testify to that great communion between God and Israel, right? The great contact. But maybe the Mishkan is Edus in the same way that the Luchos are Edus. In other words, Edus is not shorthand for the tablets. Rather, the tablets testify to something, and the Mishkan testifies to something. But of course, this fork in the road, if you take this fork, then the question is going to be, what'd you say, Bella? Say it loud. Exactly, what is something? What is the something that they are testifying to? We shall return.
What's the difference between the two?
Difference between two what?
The two different testimonies.
Oh, well, one is, Adus is, assuming that you're jumping one step ahead, that there is a second testimony, okay, and then we'll have to know what it is and compare it, maybe compare it to the first. But you could say, as I suggested, the first possibility, there's only one testimony. Their Adus is the testimony to the revelation at Sinai, and the Mishkan is the Mishkan because it contains the evidence of that revelation, of that communion. Okay. Asher, now here's an interesting, Pukad, which was counted, passive voice, Al-Pi Moshe. Now, Al-Pi Moshe is interesting. It means literally through the mouth of Moshe, but it seems to mean at Moshe's
behest.
That's what I was going to say. Okay, behest. Sometimes when I wanted to be very formal and they weren't listening to me anyway, and I got tired of telling my children to behave. So then I would say to them, please behest. And they were so stunned, they didn't know what it was. They were actually quiet for a little while. Ooh. Tati said we should behest. I don't know what it means, but it sounds like it might be followed by a punishment. So they got very nervous at that point. Okay, it's very important to know some of these biblical terms. Like verily. People, if you drop a verily here and there, like a person, you know, you're in the store and you're ordering something, you know, and the lady behind the counter says, "Would you like that in white or in green?" You say, "Verily, I believe I would take the white." You make the lady's day. You won't believe Harold. This lady was in there today. She verily decided. It was unbelievable. Okay. Wish there were more people like that in the world. Okay. So, Al-Pi Moshe, at Moshe's behest. And then there's this strange new piece of information. Avodas HaLevi'im. The work of the Levim. What work? Right? Biyad Itamar. So now we don't know what they do, Florence, but we know who the boss is. Right? They do whatever this was at the hand of Itamar, then Aaron HaKohen, the Levim as commanded by Itamar. And then with a Vav, which seems to be just comes in out of the blue, Uvetzalel ben Uri ben Chur Lemate Yehuda. And by the way, Bezalel did or created everything that God had commanded Moshe. V'ito, but he didn't do it alone. And with him were Oholiyov, ben Achisomach Lemate Don, Chorash v'choshev v'rokeim v'atcheles v'argamon v'solas hashoni uvashesh, the great technical experts who did all of these various crafts in the fabrication of the Mishnah and of the Mishkan. So if you will notice, and then comes the letter Samach, right, which says this, there's a break. This little unit stands alone. So it is a very strange thing, Florence. 1 minute we're talking about counting things, some kind of an inventory. Then we're talking about the work of the Levim. Then we're talking about, and by the way, the manufacturing process was Bezalel. So if you have noticed, we have just strewn black dots, pieces of what appear to be somewhat disconnected fragments of information about the Mishkan, we have strewn them over the field. Now imagine this field is our clear piece of plastic. So then is the question, let's look for the picture which these dots describe. And the first one that I will that I'll share with you is the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh tells us, now let's go back to where we were before. Bella, remember we took the fork in the road? And now we're going back to the fork. What could the Edus, the testimony, be? Testifying what? Yes, Danny.
Well, if it's a different testimony than the first,
yeah,
it's a testimony to creation. Because the Mishkan is said to be creation.
A microcosmic model of the universe. That is an excellent nomination for that Edus. And we know that the concept of testifying to God's creation, that's one of the reasons there's a custom that on Friday night, when you say the paragraph after the Amidah, Vayichulu Hashamayim V'Aretz, that you should say it together with others, and if someone finishes late, someone should join that person. Why? Because it is testimony to God as the Creator. Testifying that this is God's world, which is, after all, what Shabbos is about. And it's also the reason, according to those people who have the custom of standing, at least during the first paragraph of Kiddush, you stand because you stand as a witness. However, there are other schools of thought. Rashi, for example, Rashi says quite simply, Edus li Yisrael sheviter lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'maaseh ha'egel. That the Mishkan was testimony that God had indeed forgiven Israel for the sin of the golden calf. And this is an interpretation which is beautifully elaborated by the Ramban, which is in turn beautifully elaborated by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livrocha, in one of his most beautiful sichot. And he says, you have to imagine, this young couple that is getting married, and they both come from families that have a few bucks, and they design this beautiful home, this beautiful apartment with specially made furniture, none of this IKEA junk, and it's gorgeous, and it's all the floors are in the are in expensive marble and materials, a pa 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 pa. And 3 days before the wedding, the groom discovers the bride in an unfelicitous infidelity with
flagrante.
That maybe that as well, with the best man or something like that. And everything goes to pot, and they're everybody is hysterical. 3 days they don't know it's gonna be on, it's gonna be off. Finally he says, all right. So he goes through with the wedding, and she's like trembling. Like, is this what's gonna be like this? And he takes her into the beautiful home that they designed together. And by so doing, he signifies that we will go together and reclaim all of those beautiful dreams, despite the rupture in the relationship. And so when God gives them the opportunity after the golden calf to build the Mishkan, and then his divine presence comes and inhabits it, that is the Edus. They are looking for testimony, for evidence, if you will, that God has returned to Israel and that they are forgiven. So that is a very beautiful interpretation, but it's not the last. The Or HaChaim, where did I promise to start? The Sforno or the Or HaChaim? Did I promise?
Who did you just quote?
That was giving you background. That was Rashi and the Ramban. Those were all free. This one was Danny Lang. By the way, Danny, I have to tell you, I didn't do a thorough read, but I went through your manuscript, your book,
the new book.
Mm-hmm. It is really amazing.
I like it very much.
Amazing piece of work. Amazing breadth of scholarship in the different disciplines. Kol hakavod. So I really enjoyed. I went through every page.
I've got a new edition.
But I have an original.
What book is it?
This man, while the rest of the world is watching television and bowling and doing whatever they want, this man has spent 30 years making himself into a Talmud Chacham, and just the most brilliant insights and chidushim. It's just amazing. Just shows you, if I tell you the truth, it makes me regret that I didn't take things seriously when I was young. I could have a couple of books already.
And you can do it now.
Well, looks like I'm going to have time on my hands, so...
I couldn't do it until I retired.
Yeah, I thought I'd write detective novels, to tell you the truth. Anyway, so... But there are more nominees for Eidus, and this is why I want to take you to the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh says that at the end of the collection of all of the stuff for the Mishkan, and it was tremendously successful. And you have to remember, before the Mishkan actually goes up at the end of Parshas Pikudei, try and imagine all of this material spread out. It must have taken like a couple of acres. And the beautiful woods and the tapestries and the gold. Florence goes right for the good stuff. She's not playing around. And the precious stone. It was impressive. But don't you know there were a couple paskudniaks who were wondering, Moshe Rabbeinu is a politician. I bet he lined his pockets. You can imagine he slipped in a few of those carbuncles. You know, that those go for big bucks. And at the end of the process, at the end of the parsha, all this stuff is lying on the lot. And everyone has a share. But it just isn't coming together. Until Moshe Rabbeinu himself comes, and at his hand, the entire Mishkan rises into majestic harmony. Everything in its right place. So the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says that the essence of Parshas Pikudei already manifest in its first verses is an absolute vindication of the honesty and the integrity of Moshe Rabbeinu. And it's remarkable, because he says, Eile pekudei ha-mishkan mishkan ha-edus. He says, what is the edus? The mishkan, which means when it actually came up and became the tent. It was testimony to what floor? It was house of God. But what did it testify? That building, the whole structure, whispered a message. What was the message, Florence?
Torah.
Was you listening?
Yeah.
Florence says it was Torah. A good effort. And indeed, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, in a secondary interpretation, says that might be it.
Uh-huh.
You're not wrong. And Jessica wants you to feel encouraged. Continue to do your good thinking. He says the message of the Mishkan was the integrity and the unique role of Moshe Rabbeinu. How is that? Because we know the Mishkan, Moshe pulled, the Mishkan came together at the hand of Moshe. So the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says, yeah, but maybe that was for other reasons. So he says, why is the Mishkan, how do we know that the Mishkan is the proof of Moshe's great integrity? Well, he says, what were the other possibilities? So you might have thought, maybe Moshe was successful because he was so physically strong. I mean, he must have been, carried those big rocks up and down a mountain. He must have been a very, a well worked out guy.
Went to the gym a lot.
Big. He went to the gym so often that he called it James. He was so formal was his reputation. So it says you think it was muscle? He wasn't the only one with muscle, and that's why it says Avodas Halaviyim Biyad Isamar Ben Aaron HaKohen. Who was it who normally erected and took down the Mishkan? There were Levim who could do this every time. So how come, Florence might ask, how come the first day the guys who would put it up and take it down for 40 years couldn't do a thing with it? Answer, they didn't get, I'm talking about before, they were still in their prime. You know why they couldn't do it?
Why?
Because only Moshe could do it. The first time was only Moshe because it was, and it was not a matter of physical strength. Because if it were physical strength, they would have done it. So says the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh, but maybe it wasn't physical strength. As everybody knows, anybody who's gone to shul a long time, you see a young fellow who's inexperienced, right? He can be as muscle-bound as Jack LaLanne, right? And you send him over to do Hagba, to lift up the Sefer Torah. And it's all over the place. Right? And he's dropping it and it's swaying back and forth, and half the ladies are already, oh no, I can't watch. Lady, you could use a little weight loss. Maybe you should watch. So he's all over the place. And then you see an older gentleman, from my age for example, who knows the technique, knows a little physics. The older gentleman comes to the same Torah, and he slides it down, and he uses the edge of the shulchan for leverage, and he, first of all, he makes it sure it's tightly rolled, and he pushes down, that Torah goes straight up in the air, and he's going back and turning around, showing it off to everybody, and this young guy is turning blue. He is so embarrassed. This old geezer just showed me up. Why? The old geezer, you know what they say in Jamaica? I thought you'd want to know this. Clearly, none of you do much traveling. What they say in Jamaica is, how does that go again? The new broom sweeps clean, but the old broom knows the corners. So, sometimes it's not a question of strength, it's a question of technique. So maybe Moshe Rabbeinu knew how to pick up the Mishkan because he was had it up here, if not here. He knew Chochmah. So the Chumash is telling you another dot. It wasn't Chochmah. Because for Chochmah, we had Bezalel and Aholiyav, etc., etc. We had all of these people who were so brilliant. How brilliant was Bezalel? And this the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh says, we really didn't. Bezalel made it into Vayakel three times. And he's in a couple other parshas before that. Why is the Chumash now mentioning Bezalel again? He says he's putting Bezalel in here because this is not about Bezalel this time, the architect of the Mishkan. You know how he got that name? Because when he was born, his parents left him on the doorstep of a famous art school in Yerushalayim. And they named him Bezalel after the school. And his entire life, he gave thanks that they did not leave him on the doorstep of the Evelina de Rothschild, because he would have gone through his whole life named Evelina. He probably would have needed a lot of therapy. So that is the story of how Bezalel got his. I thought you'd want to know that too. Rabbi. These are important pieces of information to impart. Rabbi. Yes, Jessica could care less. Get back to the serious stuff.
Who was the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, and when did he live?
Oh, you see, if you'd come last week, I'd have given you the whole story. In short, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh was a contemporary of the Baal Shem Tov. And he lived in the, if I'm not mistaken, mostly in the first half of the 18th century.
Do you know what his name was?
Yes, Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar. Some people just called him Hank. But I wasn't that on a formal basis with it because I was a very young person when he died. Yes?
Well, maybe it doesn't refer to Moshe actually physically lifting up the Mishkan, but he was the only one who knew how to read the IKEA manual because God had shown him, as I have shown you.
I appreciate the reference to the IKEA manual. However, the Midrash says that the IKEA manual actually went directly to Bezalel. Because Bezalel, if you read carefully, it says, it doesn't say that Bezalel built the Mishkan according to the instructions that he heard from Moshe. Rather, it says, he built it, Osa Eis Kol Asher Tzivo Hashem Es Moshe. He did everything that God had commanded Moses, and that's why the Midrash says his name was Betzel Kale, that he was, because he knew things that Moshe didn't even tell him.
But those are the details of each item, how to put it all together.
All right, maybe. But the Or HaChaim HaKadosh is moving in another direction. The Or HaChaim says that Moshe, when Moshe Rabbeinu brought the Mishkan together, it was not because he had the superior chochmah, which means a kind of a skill, an understanding of the underlying principles. According to the Or HaChaim's intention, it was because Moshe had this v'zehu eduso heyoso niki kapayim she'ein chamas bekapav. That's the beautiful language of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, borrowed from the psalmist. It is because Moshe's hands were completely clean and there was no ill-gotten gain connected with him in any way. So I would say to you, this does not just mean that Moshe Rabbeinu did not pilfer from the supplies. I mean, you know, guys, Moshe Rabbeinu, you really think, you know, he was going to stash a carbuncle? This means much more than that. This means that there was nothing about his work for the Mishkan that Moshe took to feed his own ego. Yeah. It means it was done with an absolute purity of intention. And his focus was only for the glory of God. And then I would add, the Or HaChaim does not say this, so that if it doesn't sound right, blame it on JR. There's something else that you notice here. What do you notice here, by the way? The difference between all of the other characters who are mentioned, the Levim, and even Itamar, and Bezalel, and Aliyav. What do you notice about each of them? Bella, I'm looking at your phone. What do you notice about each of them?
They're terrible names.
Well, but their mother liked them. Maybe it was named.
They worked in unison.
Who does? They.
They all worked in unison together. I was thinking that it was kind of like the first time that I can think of that you could use the rallying cry. I'm Yisrael Chaim. That Moshe was like unifying.
Oh, now you're saying good.
Unifying.
Say good, say better. Say, oh boy.
Terrible experience, the terrible things that they did, but yet Hashem wanted them to be unified. He wanted to make them into a nation.
Okay, so
like
you're
an example of Am Yisrael Chai.
You're on the right track. Hit the horse again. Hit the horse again. You're on the right track. What's going on here? If you notice each of these people, everyone is mentioned what?
With a genealogy.
Every one of them has a tribal designation. We know which of the tribes they came from. Now, one of the great problems of all of Jewish history is the question, are you a Jew Or are you a member of the tribe of Judah, Reuven, whatever you want? The notion of a single identity shared by everyone is a problem that plagues Jewish history straight through. It's very interesting, right? We happen to, this morning, right here at this very table at 6 a.m. If you stay 20 minutes after the shir, we'll be back. The Gemara in Horios, based on the Mishnah, there are one or two shitos in the Mishnah which speak about Shvatim. If seven of the Shvatim sin, if six of the Shvatim, but which have more than half the population and all these things, still surviving into the mentality of the Mishnah was tribal identity. Now, this business of tribal identity did not always work out very nicely. First of all, if you look through the Tanakh, I mean, you have stories in the book of Judges and the book of Kings where tribes made war on other tribes, right? Then you have the split between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, largely what? Each one led by a different tribal confederation. And of course, this problem goes back to the beginning of Jewish history, where you have the children of Yaakov, who are the ancestors of each of the tribes. But if you understand it, if you're, by the time you're living in the land of Israel, any time between the conquest of Joshua until the exile of the 10 lost tribes during the period of the first temple, you look upon those stories in Sefer Bereshis as, in a sense, the generating machlokes myth of your life. In other words, how do we know we hate those people? Why? Because their great-great-great-grandfather didn't get along with our great-great-great-grandfather. And we're still upset. It's like the Hatfields and the McCoys, lahavdil. I mentioned that in case there's anybody religious listening. So this tribal business, and what does Moshe symbolize? Moshe's great integrity is not only that he transcends personal gain and even personal ego. His greatness is that the Jewish people are unified in the love of his heart. And as Bella was saying, he turned the Mishkan into the first great shared project of Klal Yisrael. Remember, the Midrash has them going out of Egypt in 12 different lanes. I mean, can you imagine this? Everybody, you know, it was like the New Jersey Turnpike gone crazy. You know, it wasn't like just cars here, trucks and buses over there. It was Reuven here and Levi there. Can you imagine just trying to get to the rest area? You had to cross 12 lanes of other tribes. Right? Until you got to the coffee, you could probably go crazy. And Moshe Rabbeinu is free from all of that. And that's why he put the Mishkan right in the center. Because it was accessible to everyone. It was everyone's Mishkan. It was a symbol of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, that the Ribbono Shel Olam, who loves us and whom we share and whom we serve together, transcends. So notice, when it mentions Moshe, it doesn't say that Moshe's a Levi, because he was something beyond that. That was his Niki Kapayim. That was his perfect purity. And that's why when he pulls the chain, the Mishkan comes together. So for the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, these random dots on the field mark the shape of the unique character of Moshe Rabbeinu, specifically vis-a-vis the construction and the erection of the Mishkan. It's almost like you step back and suddenly you see writ large across Jewish history the epitaph, the legacy of this extraordinary personality who did not want to be personally credited. He wanted this Mishkan to belong only to us. But in the fact that we are us, his belief in the one God and the one people is manifest. It's just remarkable. Now, let's take a slight departure from the Orach Chaim HaKadosh and spend our last minutes visiting with the Sforno. Now, generally speaking, if you were to take a poll of architects, the Mishkan would score pretty low on the most important edifice of Jewish history. In other words, obviously, the Mishkan is like training wheels, right? Waiting to get to the Temple of Solomon, and even the temple, the second temple, but especially as it was elaborated by Herod, things get much grander. I mean, you can imagine the Mishkan. I mean, with all due respect to its appointments, it wasn't much more than a souped-up Bedouin-style tent.
Well, it had to be picked up and moved every
time. Exactly. And it wasn't, the ceiling wasn't that high. And it was, after all, made of laying shmatas on top of each other. I mean, high-class shmatas, but, you know, it wasn't exactly the Ritz-Carlton. And yet the Sforno says that the beginning of Parshas Pikudei is an ode to the Mishkan. And he says, his language is so beautiful. He says that indeed, this Mishkan, unlike the others, never in Jewish history is there any report that the Mishkan of Moshe Rabbeinu was captured by enemies, was looted, fell into disrepair. None of those kinds of imperfections. And he tells us that the Pekudei HaMishkan, he says, Kol Echod Michelke HaMishkan HaKsuvim Lamala. Heim Osom HaPekudim Shenemar Aleim Uvishmos Tifkedu Es Kelei Mishmeres Masa'om Biyadi Tamar. That the Ki kol echad mehem hoyoroi lios nechshav ulhikorei b'shem kasher hu ze haprati. Says the Sforno, it's a fascinating thing. He says that not only the main things like the altar and the menorah, not just the main pieces of furniture, but he says every vessel in the Mishkan was worthy to be named and was unique and was irreplaceable. Imagine a structure, imagine a palace in which every teaspoon is an irreplaceable masterpiece. I mean, just imagine if you had a set of dishes, and one is painted by Leonardo, and another is painted by Michelangelo, and another is painted by Raphael, and another is painted by Botticelli, and you have this match set, you have service for 12. Service for 12? You don't have service for 12. You have the National Gallery. Imagine it. Believe me, you take care who cleared the dishes on Shabbos. He says, but that was the Mishkan. Every single implement was a masterpiece, and none was ever lost. He says, and this quality was exclusive to the Mishkan, And he goes through the very interesting. He says, and the Torah here is Siper Ma'alos Zehamishkan. Shebishvilom Hoyoroi Lios Nitzchi Veshalo Lipo Biad Oivim. He says the Torah here is recording the particular qualities of this Mishkan, which made it eternal and which prevented it from ever falling into enemy hands. And what are those qualities? Very clever. He says, Mishkan ha'edus. Number one, Shehoya Mishkan ha'edus, Shehoya bo luchos ha'edus. Going back to the original interpretation that Jessica offered us, that it was unique because at its center were the tablets of the Ten Commandments, the most tangible evidence of the moment of revelation. Further, Asher Pukad al Pi Moshe, because they were numbered, if you will, organized by Moshe. In other words, the presiding genius was a person of such unique stature, standard, right? Three, Shehoisa Avodas HaLevim Biad Itamar, that the preservation of all of these pieces was, because you probably were wondering this, what are you sticking in here, the Levim? The Levim were, in essence, they were the custodians. You're going to tell me that the custodians are that crucial to the identity? He says, yes. He says, because when you have something which is so extraordinary, even those who are appointed to the custodial tasks are exalted people. In other words, who took care of it? Only the Levim. And then he goes on and forth, with the description of Bezalel, that Bezalel himself was a saintly character, and therefore the Shekhinah rested on not only the Mishkan in general, but on the Mishkan in all of its elements. Then he gives you, he says, Avol Mikdash Shlomo. But the first temple, the Temple of Solomon, which we usually think of as being the great achievement, Shehoyu Osei HaMalocha Bo Mitzur. We know that he got involved with Hiram, king of Tyre. Right? He was the guy who invented Goodyear. He was the king of Tyre. Right? You saw that coming, right? Suppose under the table already from that one. He says, and even though generally the Shekhinah rested on it, its individual elements, its parts, fell apart. How do we know? Because later on in the Book of Kings, we know that they had to collect money for Bedek HaBayis to shore up the cracks. We never had to collect to fix up the Mishkan. Mishkan never fell apart. And he says, in the end it fell. And then the Bayis Sheni didn't have the benefit of the Luchos, so there was no Shekhinah. And it was built largely by non-Jews, and therefore it fell completely. It was looted and fell into the hand of Gentiles. So what does this tell you? It's a remarkable thing. And it has I've got to look at Dab Marav in a minute. 30 seconds. The implication of the Sforno is that the Jewish people goes back to its childhood, to its first relatively simple tabernacle. That is when we had our best. That is when we achieved a kind of a purity, a simplicity, a perfection. And everything after that, when we became worldly and when we embraced the material comforts of prosperity, we never again were able to build an eternal structure that the predator time could not corrupt. It's a very remarkable Sforno. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Enjoyed to have
but
you.
But God was there for the building of the Mishkan.
You. That definitely helped.
I think it helped a lot.